Welcome to Parents Perspective. Casey, his mom called gently, time to come out now, we have to go. Silence. 4-year-old Casey remained curled up under the kitchen table, sucking his thumb. Casey's mom peeked under the table. I see you, she said brightly. I know where you're hiding. Come out, come out. Silence. Casey tugged on his hair and drew his legs up more tightly. Casey, his mom sighed and shook her head. I know you don't feel like coming with us today, but we did promise Uncle Carl and Aunt Edie we'd visit. So please come on out so we can get going. Silence. His mom bent down and slid halfway under the table so she was face to face with her son. He looked so forlorn that she reached out to stroke his cheek. He closed his eyes. Go away, he murmured. I just want to be here. From a parent's perspective, what should we know about early childhood depression? I'm Sandy Burt.
And I'm Linda Perlis. Our guest has visited with Parents Perspective before when we discussed anxiety in young children. Dr. Daniel Pine is chief of the Section on Development and Affective Neuroscience and chief of Emotion and Development Branch in the Mood and Anxiety Disorders Program at the National Institute of Mental Health Intramural Research Program. He has been engaged in research focusing on the epidemiology, biology, and treatment of psychiatric disorders in children and adolescents. His areas of expertise include biological and pharmacological aspects of mood, anxiety, and behavioral disorders in children. His most recent research uses methods from neuroscience to study normal and abnormal emotional development. Dr. Pine has also received a number of awards. He's the father of 3 children. Welcome back to Parents Perspective, Dr. Pine.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
How can parents tell if a young child is depressed?
Well, it can be difficult for many children. And the important thing to know is that there is a broad range of behaviors or emotional things that kids will do that are all normal. So many parents wonder, is this just an extreme kind of behavior that's normal, or is this an extreme kind of behavior that's not normal? And it can be difficult both for parents and even for mental health professionals, since there is so much variability in terms of what's normal, to definitively say that this behavior or this problem is a clear sign of abnormality, or this behavior or this problem is something that's normal. There are a couple of guides that parents and mental health professionals can use. One is the idea of what we call impairment. And the idea behind impairment is that if a behavior or an emotion that a child is displaying interferes with that child's ability to do things that other children that child's age can do, then parents should be concerned. So, for example, it's normal for a lot of children on one day or another day to maybe not want to go to school. But if the behavior actually prevents the child from going to school, then parents should be concerned. It's normal for some kids to be sad one day and not want to do the kind of things that they usually enjoy. But the child who actually follows through and doesn't do those things, we're more concerned about that child than we are about the child who might be a little sad, but when pushed, we'll go ahead and we'll engage in all the activities that other children will engage in. So that's probably the best first rule, this idea of impairment. A second rule to keep in mind is that one of the differences between emotional problems that are actually a sign that something is wrong and emotional problems that are just kind of typical of the kind of fluctuations that kids exhibit is that problems tend to last. So the kid who is upset for an entire day, every single day, for a week, is more likely to have a problem than a kid who just gets down and upset one day here, one day there, but it doesn't last. It doesn't last the whole day, and it doesn't go on for many days in a row.
Since children's moods and attention spans are so transient, wouldn't depression also be a short-term occurrence? In other words, a week or you know, something.
It frequently is. And parents can be reassured that their child's behavior is normal or typical if there are transient episodes of sadness. And by transient, I mean that they don't last the whole day and they don't go on many days in a row. It's relatively typical for children to have bad days here and there. What we worry about is a bad day that goes on for the whole day and that starts to last most days for more than a week. That's kind of our threshold for mental health practitioners of thinking, oh, gee, maybe something could be wrong here. That doesn't mean that something's definitely wrong. There can be occasions where children can be sad for as long as a week, and it can be a normal reaction to an extreme situation, to a stressor, or just a bad time. But the longer that sadness or anxiety or upset feelings last, the more likely it is to be a sign of a problem. And for parents who might be listening to your show today, the figure that they should have in mind is a week. If a child has a bad week, a parent need not be that upset and need not be that concerned. But if a bad mood or a period of being highly anxious goes on, even if the child's able to do all the other things that another child can do, if that period goes on for a week or longer, then parents should start asking themselves, gee, is this normal? Is this typical? Because the chances that it's not normal increase around that period of time.
Do you have a feel for what causes early childhood depression? And the other side of that is, does it tend to run in families?
Most complex individual differences in behaviors in children, and by complex, I mean that they're not easy to describe with just one word or one phrase. Most of those kinds of behavioral differences are not caused by any one thing. They tend to be complex mixes of a bunch of different things, all acting together in ways that we don't completely understand. So clearly, there are familial components, which means that problems with anxiety and problems with depression do tend to run in families. So children whose parents have a problem with depression are more likely themselves to have problems with depression. But most children whose parents have depression actually do fine. Moreover, there are plenty of children who develop signs of depression who do not have any family history of depression. So what that tells us is that no one factor acting on its own is enough to cause depression, that there's a very complex mix of things that goes into that formula. It's a little bit like the way we think about heart disease. Heart disease has many different things that all mix together. So if you smoke, that increases your risk. If you have a family history of heart disease, that increases your risk. If you have diabetes, that increases your risk. Or if you have high cholesterol, that increases your risk. And it's kind of the addition of all these things together that really puts people over the edge and contributes to heart disease. We're at a much earlier stage in terms of understanding mental illnesses relative to illnesses of the heart, but we're starting to understand that some of the lessons we've learned about things like heart disease or even cancer also apply to mental disorders. So where we're really focusing right now is trying to understand what are all these main risk factors, and we're starting to understand that. Things like having a family history of depression, or things like being under a lot of stress. We're starting to identify those things. What we're just beginning to do is to figure out how those things all mix together and how they impact on the way in which the brain functions. Because just like with heart disease, we think that things in the environment and things in your genes all interact to shape how the heart functions, so it is with mental disorders. We think that things in the environment and things in your genes all interact and impact on brain function, and that's how depression ultimately is caused.
We'll take a short break now and be right back to continue our discussion on depression in early childhood.
The popular new book, Raising a Successful Child, Discover and Nurture Your Child's Talents, by Sandra Burt and Linda Perlis, is available at all major bookstores and on the web.
Welcome back to Parents Perspective. We are talking with Dr. Daniel Pine about depression in very young children.
Is there work being done on the chemistry of the brain?
The way that we think about the brain most recently is that we think about it from what's called a circuitry-based perspective. And so the idea is that we're starting to understand what are the individual components in the brain structurally, how those components fit together, what are the connections among them, and how each of those different parts of the brain work together to shape certain behaviors. We do know that the chemistry of the brain impacts on how those circuits work, but we're really very early in terms of trying to understand what are all the different parts of those circuits and how they fit together. And we're not really going to understand how chemicals shape functions in those circuits until we understand the basic architecture of those circuits, and that's something that we don't understand yet.
If a pediatrician, teacher, or caregiver suspects that a child has depression, what should parents do?
There are three main groups of people who tend to recognize problems in kids, and those are the three people that you mentioned, parents, teachers, and pediatricians. And there's been some debate in the field in terms of what is the best way to work with those three different groups of people to get children with problems the services that they need. Many people think, at least right now, that a particularly good entry point is the pediatrician, because we do think of emotional problems like depression as a variety of medical problem. And pediatricians are in a good position to begin to start to think about which mental health problems are relatively serious and which ones are relatively benign. So pediatricians, if you don't know where else to turn, are often a very good place to go. That said, there's a lot of variability in terms of how comfortable pediatricians are with dealing with mental health issues and the training that pediatricians have. That some pediatricians have a great amount of sensitivity, a great amount of interest, and a great amount of training. And they're uniquely situated to help parents and to help schools with mental health problems. Others are not that well situated. And the field is struggling now to figure out how we can best use the people who are knowledgeable and who are interested, be they pediatricians, be they psychologists, social workers, or child psychiatrists like myself. How can the pediatricians who are on the front lines all work together to get the children who need services, services right away?
What are the treatment options that parents are looking at or could be looking at?
There's really only two or three that have been shown to work. So one of them is medication with what are called selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, or SSRIs. And those treatments actually are reasonably good treatments. There's a fair amount of controversy about them. The bottom line is that they are reasonable treatments. They're not panaceas, so it's not a common occurrence for these medications to have side effects, but a sizable minority of children will have side effects that will interfere with the ability to take the medication. The second treatments are psychotherapies, and there have been two groups of psychotherapies that have been studied relatively rigorously for depression. The best studied treatment is something called cognitive behavioral therapy, or CBT. And the evidence is also pretty good that that treatment is effective. Probably the biggest advantage to CBT is that it does not have a lot of the side effects that go along with SSRI medications. To do CBT, a child has to really want to do it. And particularly for young children, you can imagine this might be especially hard. So that's one problem with it. The second problem is that only one study has directly compared CBT medication with a placebo or a sugar pill and with an SSRI medication. And in that study, which is a particularly important study, the SSRI medication was better than placebo, and it was also better than CBT. But the CBT treatment, at least when it was given alone, was not better than placebo. From all that we know about SSRI medications and CBT is that they're both reasonable treatments. And it's hard to say, on average, which one is better than the other, that's the kind of decision that parents really need to make when considering the individual needs of their child with their own mental health practitioner. The last treatment to just mention is another form of psychotherapy called interpersonal psychotherapy, and that in some ways is similar to CBT in that both of these treatments are relatively focused on the here and now. They really try to help children with things that are actively consuming their thoughts and their time and that are making children upset. So both of those psychotherapies are similar in that way. The focus, however, is somewhat different in the two kinds of psychotherapy. So in CBT or cognitive behavioral therapy, the idea is that children get into a certain rigid way of thinking that distorts the way they look at the world. So they tend to look at the world from an overly pessimistic or an overly negative way. And the idea behind CBT is if we can teach children to look at the world in a more positive way, we can actually change their moods. The idea behind the second psychotherapy, interpersonal psychotherapy, is that depression is intimately related to social relationships. We know that from studies that have been done. And the idea behind interpersonal therapy is that it is problems in relationships that cause depression. So the idea behind that therapy is that the therapist works with the child and the family to try to encourage children and families to have healthier relationships. So again, both of those psychotherapies have a fair amount of evidence to suggest that they're helpful, and they're clearly better than a lot of other treatments that have been studied. However, again, one treatment that's compared placebo or sugar pill to psychotherapy and medication, to the extent that we could say that one of the treatments was better than the other, the evidence seemed to suggest that the medication offered a quicker response than the psychotherapy.
We'll take a short break now and be right back to finish our discussion on depression in early childhood.
For an audio CD of any parent's perspective show, send a check or money order for $15 with your name, mailing address, and phone number to Parents Perspective, P.O. Box 42283, Washington, D.C. 20015.
Welcome back to Parents Perspective. We're talking with Dr. Daniel Pine about depression in very young children. Dr. Pine, I've read that a lot of this research on medications has not been conducted with very small children. And so how are doses decided on?
The overwhelming majority of the research has been done with school-aged children and adolescents. So everything we know is based on the most rigorous evidence applied to children who are at least of school age. We know very little about what kind of treatments might work best for preschool children. And what mental health professionals tend to do when they don't have evidence is they just extrapolate down. They say, well, if these treatments work this way for school-age children and this way for adolescents, we're going to assume that they work the same way for preschool children. The problem is that that's not always the case. So there's a great need for more research in general on depression in preschoolers, but in particular on the different kinds of treatments that work best for depression as well as anxiety in preschool children. Once we have some evidence that a treatment works, like medication, then we start asking somewhat more refined questions, like what's the right dose to use? And at least in preschool children, we have not even gotten to that stage where we can definitively say this is the right dose to use. We can be reassured, however, by the fact that for the main medications used in children and adolescents, these SSRI medications, these selective serotonin reuptake inhibitor medications, they have what we call a broad therapeutic window. And what that means is that there's a very broad range of doses that we can use without increasing the risk of particularly dangerous side effects.
What is the prognosis for a young child treated for depression, and what is the likelihood that it will return later in the child's life?
We know most about prognosis in school-age children and adolescents, and we know a far greater amount about school-age children and adolescents than we do about preschool children. And there are two basic lessons that we know. One lesson that we know is that there is a pretty big difference in the prognosis between anxiety and depression, that many school-age children with anxiety grow up to have only transient problems, even if their problems look relatively severe. So probably more than half of children with serious impairing anxiety disorders will grow up to have relatively minimal impact on their overall functioning. In terms of depression, we know the prognosis is not as good. So for school-age children and adolescents who have a problem with depression, more than half of them are going to have their problem recur. The second thing that we can say is these problems, both anxiety and depression, tend to do what we call wax and wane. They tend to come and go. So the hopeful thing, even if your child has depression, is that it is possible to get your child into remission with appropriate treatment. The last thing to say is, while we have a lot less evidence from preschool children, the evidence that we do have suggests that problems in preschoolers behave similarly to problems in school-age children. So problems with anxiety in preschoolers, much like school-age children, are more common than problems with depression. And problems with anxiety have a better prognosis in preschoolers than problems with depression. So as a parent, if you're concerned about your child because they're showing signs of emotional problems, it's really important to speak with your pediatrician or to get access to other mental health professionals so that you can figure out what kind of problem does your child have and that you can get appropriate treatment to your child as quickly as possible.
What kinds of resources would you suggest for our listeners who want to further pursue some of the issues we've been discussing?
So there are three great places to turn if you want more information about mental health services that are available. Probably the first place to turn is your pediatrician, and to speak with your pediatrician about what's the nature of the problem that your child is having and where are the closest local services where mental health services can be provided to your child. The second one is the National Institute of Mental Health, or the NIMH, has many resources, either through the website, which can just be found by typing NIMH into Google, or through two phone numbers at my group, either for problems with anxiety. The phone number is 301 451 601-451-6817. That's 301-451-6817. Or for problems with irritability and negativistic and depressed behavior, 301-496-8381. And then the third place is over the internet. And you need to be careful about the sites that you check on the internet, because some of them are better informed than others. But a wonderful first place to start is the American Academy of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry, or AACAP. And again, you can just type that into Google, AACAP, and you'll be taken to that site.
Well, this has been a very enlightening time for both of us and for our listeners. So, Dr. Daniel Pine, thank you so much for being with us and helping us learn more about early childhood depression.
Absolutely.
Our gift for our first caller is an autographed copy of The Little Book, a collection of stories, articles, parenting tips, and resources for all parents and caregivers, especially those who love and care for children and teens with special needs. Just call us toll-free at 1-800-791-8573 with your name and mailing address. That's 1-800-791-8573 with your name and mailing address. And please spell anything that's not obvious. That's a big help to us. Mention show number 458 and tell us, if you can, what station you're listening into.
Visit our website, www.parentsperspective.org, where you can even listen to a show of your choice. This is Sandy Burt and Linda Perlis. We're glad you could share Parents Perspective. At the end of our program, we often thank individuals or organizations for their generous donations that help with the cost of producing Parents Perspective. Parents Perspective is a 501c3 nonprofit corporation. Donations can be made online through GiveDirect or iGive.com or MissionFish at eBay. Or you can mail checks or money orders to Parents Perspective Incorporated, Post Office Box 42283, Washington, D.C. 20015. Thank you for helping us continue to work for you. Our sound engineer is Nate DeLuca. And music for this program was composed and performed by Jonathan Burt.